court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Pistol shots ring out in the barroom night. Enter Patty Valentine from the upper hall. She sees the bartender in a pool of blood, cries out, "My God, they've killed them all."
Is this a true story? Are you entertaining me? What's happened? What was the deal? What's
That's my Shatner-esque doing? Dramatic reading of The Hurricane by Bob Dylan.
Oh, I remember that song.
Yeah. Did you like my Shatner impression?
Well, I didn't really pick up on it that it was a Shatner impression.
My God, they've killed them all.
Well, all right, William. Captain Kirk, as it were.
Well, do you know why I brought up The Hurricane?
Because... he was famous in a song by Bob Dylan.
Yeah, we're going to do famous Bob Dylan songs.
Okay.
No, it's because...
I'll take Bob Dylan for 500.
Because he was wrongfully convicted of a crime.
Oh, he was wrongfully convicted.
Yeah.
Well, I knew that Bob was singing to get him out, but I didn't remember if he got out. Hurricane Carter, wasn't
That's
it?
Right. Yep. So this was kind of... this idea was somewhat suggested by Christopher Steer. He posted a story about Martin Tankleff, who was wrongly convicted and received $10 million after being in prison for 17 years.
Oh, yeah. I saw that on there.
Chris posted that on our Facebook page, which if you're not on there, you should go check it out.
I am on there.
I am, too.
I check it out pretty much every day.
So, after being released, Martin Tankleff filed suit in 2009, and when the prosecuting attorney decided not to retry him. And he was represented by Barry Scheck, one of the co-founders of the Innocence Project. And he was awarded $10 million, as I said, for his stay for 17 years in the prisons.
As well he should be.
Yeah.
Money alone is not enough. You've lost your life.
That's true.
I mean, money can't do it. It can't make up for what they've taken from you.
Sometimes when you go for money against the state for wrongfully imprisoning you, it's set by statute or code, capped. Mm-hmm. For example, in Florida... it's capped at $2 million for no matter how long it is.
Really?
$50,000 a year. So they cap it. Yeah.
Wow.
So, and then like in West Virginia, basically it's based upon a fair and reasonable sum, whatever that might be.
I would think the longer you're in, the more you should get. And capping it doesn't seem right.
Yeah. That's a problem with caps. Caps tend to really only hurt people that are actually really hurt. The problem is that when you limit the total amount somebody can get, the only way you can usually get that large amount is when you're actually prove those damages. So it happens a lot in things like this and also like medical malpractice type things where people are really hurt and wrongful death. Whenever you hit that cap, you can't go any higher.
Well, mostly where I have heard of caps is like in malpractice suits.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times places, I know West Virginia was one of those places that was judged as a judicial hellhole because people would come here and get multi-million dollar settlements.
Right.
So one of the things they talked about trying to clean up that type of a reputation was to put caps on what you could get for different malpractice things. But trying to determine what's an arm worth or what's a brain injury worth or what's a life worth, that's just hard to do to lump into legislation.
It is. And like I said, caps don't really work. They only hurt people who are really hurt.
This is true.
You need more of like if you really want to try to fix things, you need more of a threshold type barrier to keep people from getting into the court, but then you run into trouble of access to the courts too. So it's a kind of a problem. But to get off of our cap soapboxes here.
Yes, we're not here to talk about caps.
Chris, when he suggested he wanted to know more about the procedures, about how these things go and what happens. Well, usually whenever there's a wrongful conviction that's overturned, a lot of times it happens from like DNA evidence that gets found or some other DNA comes through the system and gets through a database. But it happens usually long after the time for an appeal has run. So your time frames for those, you don't really, you've already blown those. You can't appeal them. Or if you have appealed them, you've lost. So the way that this comes around a lot is, we've said it before, is a writ of habeas corpus, which that literally means to produce the body. And it's a court order to a person or agency holding somebody in custody to deliver the imprisoned individual to the court, issuing the order to show a valid reason for their detention. And the writ of habeas corpus is one of the old writs, oldest writs we have in the country, sometimes called an extraordinary writ. And it's one of the things that provides access to the courts for inmates whenever there's new evidence found.
And the habeas corpus is from the Latin habitual corpse.
Yes, exactly.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, already said it. Produce the body.
Oh, produce the body.
Yeah. So, but I think you did a little bit of stuff on the Innocence Project and had some ideas about how these things happen or what happens.
Yeah, I'd heard of the Innocence Project before, several different times, but, you know, the Steve Avery making a murderer and all that was, they were involved in freeing him from his first charge.
Yeah.
That brought about, you know, the initial documentary and everything. So I wanted to do a little research into the Innocence Project. It's a nonprofit legal organization that is committed to exonerating wrongly convicted people through the use of DNA testing and to reforming the criminal justice system to prevent future injustice. It was founded in 1992. The work of the Innocence Project has led to the freeing of more than 350 wrongfully convicted people based on DNA, including 20 who spent time on death row, and the finding of 150 real perpetrators. So besides getting people out of prison that were wrongfully convicted, they also were helping find the right ones.
You know, when I was looking to go briefly really back to CAPS and those statutes that give people money for being wrongfully in prison, one state, and I forget which one it was, it was $50,000 a year for being wrongfully imprisoned. But if you're on death row, it was $100,000 a year.
Oh, because you had extra sweat equity going on.
I guess, or something.
In the Innocence Project's findings, they found that incorrect identification by eyewitnesses was a factor in over 70% of the wrongful convictions. Now, the Innocence Project focuses on cases in which DNA evidence is available to be tested or retested. DNA testing is possible in 5 to 10% of criminal cases. Other members of the Innocence Network also help to exonerate those in whose cases DNA testing is not possible. In addition to working on behalf of those who may have been wrongfully convicted of crimes throughout the United States, those working for the Innocence Project perform research and advocacy related to cases of wrongful conviction. Almost all, 99% of the wrongful convictions were of males, with minority groups constituting approximately 70%. The National Registry of Exonerations lists 1,579 convicted defendants who were exonerated through DNA and non-DNA evidence from January 1st, 1989 through April 12th, 2015.
Now, I have to think that, not to interrupt, but I have to think that number, it's pretty high, but given the total number of people that were convicted of crimes during that time,
oh yeah,
it's probably a drop in the bucket.
Well, that could be, because you're looking at, what, 11, 26 years?
Yeah, in 50 states.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're pretty prolific with our criminal justice system here in the U.S.
And the other thing is, we're talking about DNA testing. It's evolved over that time period as well. There were things that you can tell now that you couldn't tell back in 1989 when they were doing that.
Yeah, back then it was just all acid wash.
Yeah, so it's a lot different procedure now. They could take the same DNA and tell you something much more specifically than they could then.
Yeah.
But according to a study published in 2014, more than 4% of persons overall sentenced to death from 1973 to 2004 are probably innocent. That's, you don't ever want to err on that side.
No.
But they gave some cases that they highlighted there, Stephen Avery's case being one of them, of ones that they did about 14 cases. But what struck me is that 9 of those 14 were African Americans that were wrongfully convicted,
yeah,
that they exonerated. The proportions, when you start looking at those things, go towards minorities strongly.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, you've got to say that there's a certain amount of racial bias in the procedures that the police follow and the procedures that the prosecutors may follow and the juries themselves. and then in the sentences.
And sometimes in the laws themselves, like you said, the sentences. Like, for example, and this is something that came to light, I forget how many years ago, but the sentence for having a certain amount of cocaine, like actual cocaine at the federal level, was one thing. But if you had crack cocaine, it was exponentially higher. And just
crack cocaine's the cheap stuff.
It was the cheap stuff. But minority-wise, it was very discriminatory.
Well, and we talked about in our marijuana episode, actually the marijuana episode was a two-parter, I think, but in a marijuana episode, we talked about how that part of the reasoning behind making it illegal was to put the burden on minorities.
Yeah. The marijuana episode was a two-parter?
I think so.
It was a two-puffer?
Was it?
Puff puff?
A two-fatty? But here's the thing. You even though you'd be excited, okay, you got out, you know, you were wrongfully convicted and you get out. Here's the average sentence served was 13 years.
Yeah.
That's 13 years of your life, you know, and that's the average. There were some that were in there. There was one of them that they talked about. He was actually being marched to his execution when the governor finally decided there was enough information. They hadn't cleared him yet, but there was enough information where they did need to stay the execution and look at this a little bit harder.
Yeah.
But he was on his way to be executed at the time that they stopped it. 70% exonerated, part of minority group.
Well, he probably got his last meal out of it, too.
Well, that's true. He probably did get to eat that. 40% of these DNA cases were able to find the actual person who committed the crime. About 50% of those exonerated through DNA testing have been financially compensated for their time in prison. The federal government, 27 states, and Washington, D.C. have passed laws providing some level of financial compensation to wrongfully convicted people.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I was talking about a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm. The Innocence Project has had to close 22% of its cases because DNA evidence was missing or had been destroyed. Now, they say about 3,000 prisoners write to the Innocence Project each year. And at any given time, the Innocence Project is evaluating 6,000 to 8,000 potential cases throughout the country. And all potential clients go through an extensive screening process to determine whether or not they are likely to be innocent. Obviously, they don't publish this because they don't want to give you the answers ahead of time.
Yeah.
Give you a chance to prepare for it because they're trying to discern who it's worth their time because they can't get everybody.
Yeah.
So they're trying to discern that.
They're triaging it.
So if they pass the process, the Innocence Project takes up their case. In roughly half of the cases that the Innocence Project takes on, the client's guilt is reconfirmed by DNA testing. So their guilt is reconfirmed by that same DNA.
Yeah.
Of all the cases taken on by the Innocence Project, about 43% of clients were proven innocent, 42% were confirmed guilty, and evidence was inconclusive and not probative in 15% of cases.
Maybe the attorney talking to that guy. It's like, hey, so I got some good news and I got some bad news. All right, well, I'll take the good news. Well, the good news is the court decided to review your DNA and do subsequent testing on it. Oh, all right. What's the bad news? Yeah, it was you.
Came back, you did it.
Yeah. Oh, well.
But I didn't. Hey, look, if the DNA will clear you, it'll convict you.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I think there are also some other things that are kind of considered low probability ways to convict people of crimes. I know we had talked before about how eyewitness corroboration is usually one of the least reliable ones, even though you would think that would be one of the better ones.
Yeah, they said eyewitness misidentification testimony was a factor in 75% of post-conviction DNA exoneration cases in the U.S., making it the leading cause of those wrongfully convicted. Studies show that people are less able to recognize faces of a different race than their own. The suggested reforms are embraced by leading criminal justice organizations that have been adopted in states of New Jersey and North Carolina in large cities like Minneapolis and Seattle. Now, what they're saying is, what they're suggesting is that an expert come in when your case is hinging on eyewitness testimony, and they should caution the jury or tell the jury about the fallacies of eyewitness identification. Because most juries, most common people are under the impression, oh, well, if this person saw him, then he did it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that is the most misleading testimony that there is eyewitness testimony. Second is unvalidated or improper forensic testing. So you have people sometimes that are doing this science that isn't really science. but they come in as expert witnesses and they testify to that. You also have, like we had the Fred Zane cases here in West Virginia.
Yeah.
Where he was worked for the FBI doing all the DNA testing and other stuff. And he basically said, look, do you think this guy's guilty? And the cops would say, yeah.
Oh.
He made the evidence match.
Spoiler alert, I'm going to go into that a bit more here in a little bit.
Oh, okay. Well, he made the evidence match. Yeah. What it was. So you have that going on in other places, too.
I think that's probably more rare.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it is. And a lot of times when people think there's some sort of conspiracy against them or they're being framed, it's probably not a conspiracy. It's probably just ineptitude, to be perfectly frank with
you. That's true. And then you have false confessions and incriminating statements.
Yeah.
Such as the nephew in the Stephen Avery case that gave the false confession on there, just, you know, low IQ and stuff like that. And they say that's what happens with a lot of them. They're usually younger people, 20 years and under, and they usually are of lower IQ. And then they fall victim to that. And then the last one that's one of the leading causes is snitches. Mm-hmm. Whenever you have somebody that's coming in to testify against you and they've got something to gain from it,
right?
You got to question how good that testimony is.
Yeah. I mean, you hear the phrase, snitches get stitches, but they actually get better plea deals too.
Yeah. If they're getting their time reduced or they're dropping a charge against them or something like that, yeah, they're going to say, this is what I heard him say or that he told me or whatever.
Whenever you have several co-defendants, it's always interesting to see who breaks and who doesn't and who starts snitching on other people. And it usually does happen at some point. So it's a very fluid game whenever you have co-defendants and different people, because it's like you wonder who's going to roll over. Well, now there's some more stuff we want to talk about with regard to these things. But I think first we have some motions before the court.
Well, yes, if it please your honor and don't convict me falsely, we'd like to approach the bench to pay court costs.
I think I recognize that face. I think it was you.
You think it was me?
That's right.
No, eyewitness accounts are vastly unreliable.
Well, this guy had a beard.
Oh, well, I don't have a beard. You better look in the mirror, pal.
Well, you know what? You wouldn't have a beard either if you used Dollar Shave Club.
And I do. That's why I don't have a beard.
Exactly.
I use Dollar Shave Club. It's our old friends from Dollar Shave Club. Good news to all humans. Dollar Shave Club is here to save you. If you ever shower or brush your teeth or try to make your hair look presentable, boy, have we got news for you. Dollar Shave Club has a lot of stuff to help you out.
Dollar Shave Club delivers everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best.
And who doesn't want to smell their best? You don't want somebody to smell you coming in a bad way before you get there.
No. You don't.
Oh, man, that's Mike coming.
Here comes Mike.
Oh, man.
Stinky dude. Mike.
Man, he didn't use his one wipe Charlie's.
Well, they have everything you need when you're getting ready in the bathroom in the morning. You can shave with them. They have the Dr. Carver shave butter that helps your beard get tamed and knocked down quickly with their super sharp razors. They got the one wipe Charlie's, which can wipe your behind.
Your butt.
They're more than just razors.
Dollar Shave Club. Yes, that Dollar Shave Club delivers everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best. You name it. Shampoo, conditioner, body wash, toothpaste, hair gel, even a wipe that'll leave your tushy feeling tingly clean.
And I'm a really big fan of their Amber and Lavender Calming Body Cleanser. I've never quite smelled anything like it, and I mean that in a good way. So... But you're not going to find that at the store. You're only going to find it on Dollar Shave Club.
All of the Dollar Shave Club's products are made with top shelf ingredients that won't break your budget. You'll feel the difference. Plus, shipping is free with your membership. And that's what's so great about it. You know, how many times when you were shaving before you had your beard, Mike, would you, you know, get down and you've got one razor left and you just stretch that one razor out because you keep forgetting to pick them up when you're at the store? And maybe that one razor doesn't feel so good anymore. But with Dollar Shave Club, you don't have that problem. It's on a schedule. They just ship. And you get them. And you can always use a fresh razor. And you never have to run out and get them or try to remember to buy them.
Nope. And their razors are sharp. They don't pull. They're great razors.
They're very good.
And here's a great way to try a bunch of Dollar Shave Club's products. For just $5, you get their Daily Essentials Starter Set. It comes with Body Cleanser, One Wipe Charlie's, for your butt. They're amazing butt wipes. Their world famous shave butter and their best razor, the 6-Blade Executive.
Keep the blades coming for a few more bucks a month and add in shampoo, toothpaste, or anything else you need. Check it all out at dollarshaveclub.com/court.
That's dollarshaveclub.com/court.
Tell them Mike and Tommy sent you.
I think I have more fun reading the ads than I do with the regular part of the podcast.
I know what you mean. This one's one of our old friends, so they're always fun to play around with. And we actually have experience with their product, so that makes it even better.
Yeah, we are avid Dollar Shave Club users.
Yeah, turn me on to it. I'll tell you that. I like them every time I see one of their things on Facebook. I like it, you know, when it's in there. I want everybody else to know about it.
I'm sure it's noted. Oh, Tommy liked it.
Oh, everybody, run and get one. Tommy liked it. Yeah, that's an endorsement there, huh? All right, we were talking about eyewitness being the most unreliable source of a witness. Now, intuitively you think, why is that right? Why is that correct? So I did some research into it, and this is what science has to say about that. They're citing a specific case that happened in 1984. Kirk Bloodsworth was convicted of the rape and murder of a 9-year-old girl and sentenced to the gas chamber, an outcome that rested largely on the testimony of 5 eyewitnesses. After Bloodsworth had served 9 years in prison, DNA testing proved him to be innocent. Such devastating mistakes by eyewitnesses are not rare. Since the 1990s, when DNA testing was first introduced, Innocence Project researchers have reported that 73% of the 239 convictions overturned through DNA testing were based on eyewitness testimony. 1/3 of those overturned cases rested on testimony of 2 or more mistaken eyewitnesses. How could so many eyewitnesses be wrong? Eyewitness identification typically involves selecting the alleged perpetrator from a police lineup, but it can also be based on police sketches and other methods. Soon after selecting a suspect, eyewitnesses are asked to make a formal statement confirming the ID and to try to recall any other details about events surrounding the crime. Surveys show that most jurors place heavy weight on eyewitness testimony when deciding whether a suspect is guilty. But although eyewitness reports are sometimes accurate, jurors should not accept them uncritically because of the many factors that can bias such reports. For example, jurors tend to give more weight to the testimony of eyewitnesses who report that they are very sure about their identifications, even though most studies indicate that highly confident eyewitnesses are generally only slightly more accurate and sometimes no more so than those who are less confident.
That's crazy.
It says basically the memories are reconstructed. The uncritical acceptance of eyewitness accounts may stem from a popular misconception of how memory works. Many people believe that human memory works like a video recorder. The mind records events and then on cue plays back the exact replica of them. On the contrary, psychologists have found that memories are reconstructed rather than played back each time we recall them. The act of remembering is more akin to putting puzzle pieces together than retrieving a video recording. Even questioning by a lawyer can alter the witness's testimony because fragments of the memory may unknowingly be combined with information provided by the questioner, leading to inaccurate recall.
Yeah. I wonder if that's why I always think that there was a Krispy Kreme donuts on Fifth Avenue in Huntington.
Because somebody told you there was?
I don't know. I have a very vivid picture of it when being younger.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that. One of the things that researchers have created false memories in normal individuals. And here's what they did. They did a study and they presented the test subjects with 4 stories from their lives, from their young lives. Mm-hmm. And they asked them to read each one of the stories and elaborate on any further memories they had of that story. So, of course, they got together with these people's families to write these things down. Of course, they couldn't make them up.
Yeah.
But 3 of the 4 were real things that happened to them. The 4th one was actually a story they made up about them getting lost like in a shopping mall when they were somewhere from 4 to 6 years old. And they just had the family tell them what mall they would be at and what the stores were.
Fill in some of the blanks.
Yeah, just so that it would be something that would be congruent with where they would have been. So then they had them read those. 33% of the people that participated in this elaborated on all four of the stories. They didn't recognize one of the four stories as being false. They actually read that and remembered that happening to them and elaborated on the story and gave other details. Then, even after that 33% was confronted with the fact, hey, this story was fake, we made this up, 25% of that group said, oh no, I remember it, it happened. And they continued to press on that they remembered that, and it was actually something that they had been through, and they would add other details.
Yeah, it's like when you mentioned something about making a murder, that was one of the things that was really brought up, is that his Stephen Avery's nephew, Brendan Dancy, I think it was. Anyway, the police, whenever they questioned him, it seemed like they kind of planted those memories in his head the way they did it. And that was one of the main things they had contended, I think, in that Making a Murder documentary, mm-hmm. was that these things were basically planted in his head by the police. And that's one of those things that's really careful too. And there is, whenever there's any allegations of sexual abuse against children or things like that, they do what's called a forensic interview. And the idea, and once a child has made some sort of statement that there might be some sort of abuse like that, mm-hmm. no one talks to them about it. And you don't want them to.
Yeah.
Because you might plant things in their head about it that's not true for this very reason. And then they conduct what's called a forensic interview, which is recorded. And it's where
you get people that are really trained in
They're trained to do it. They have a specialty to do it. And they ask them very kind of open-ended questions that kind of lead them into talking about it without being very specific. Because you have to be very careful the way you ask a question, because you could very easily plant something in somebody's head that happened, especially a young child like that.
Yeah.
So
if you ask them, did the person do this or that to you? Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, because you just told them this is something that could happen. So you have to be careful not to suggest that they might have done this or might have done that, because then that just becomes part of the story.
Exactly. So it's those forensic interviews, they're always very tough to watch because of the subject matter of them. But at the same time, it's very interesting to see the kinds of questions that they ask.
They usually use some kind of dolls and stuff, don't they?
No. Never seen a doll.
I've seen them have these ones where they showed and they would have the subject in there and they would have like a doll and they would say, now point to the areas where this took place. Because they didn't want to lead them or use terms that they might not be familiar with or give them terms that they might not be familiar with.
Well, a lot of times when in those forensic interviews, they ask them questions, they'll ask them, now, what do you call this or what do you call that, to get terminology down for whatever they call like their genitals. Because mm-hmm. kids use different names for it. So they always ask them that question. It's very kind of broad and open-ended. But yeah, I've never seen a doll. Like that might be a common misconception.
Well, maybe so, but I swear I've seen some, you know, like I watch a lot of like 48 Hours and Dateline and mm-hmm. things like that. And that's where I've seen those kind of things where they show that.
Seen a lot of them on Law and Order and, you know, CSI and...
Yeah, SUV.
Yeah, CSI SUV.
In addition, they recommend that they should allow experts on eyewitness identification to testify in court to educate juries and perhaps lead to more measured evaluation of the testimony. Most U.S. jurisdictions do not allow such experts in the court on the grounds that laboratory-based eyewitness research does not apply to the courtroom, and that in any case, its conclusions are mostly common sense and therefore not very enlightening.
Yeah.
But science would beg to differ and say that this would not only improve the court system, but it could also improve the policing system.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, you got to think, if somebody comes up, if you're a police officer and somebody comes up to you and says, hey, I saw this guy shoot this guy. What does he look like? And they give you a description. I mean, you got to think that's probably pretty accurate.
Sure. And the fact, I saw him. I saw what he looked like. So, of course, you're going to believe him.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's also one of those things where probably older people that are involved, you tend to believe them more. They're more credible, or, you know, you base it on how they look or how they're dressed. You know, you add in socioeconomic status. Well, the guy looked like he was a doctor, or he looked like he was a professor or something like that.
That man had a beard, a tie, and a tweed jacket with elbow patches.
He had to have been some kind of professor. He must have known what he was talking about. So you have those kind of things that play in. Whereas they've also done tests, and, you know, they say very little of it actually has to do with eyesight, but some of it has to do with that. And a lot of times witnesses 60 years and older are more adamant in what they've seen and more sure of what they've seen, yet when they've done testing, they found out that they are less accurate in what they actually saw than people that are like in their 20s.
Right.
But they will stand there. And I'm thinking, you know, a lot of times, and if you're in a jury and you're looking at a witness, if the guy's like a 65-year-old professor looking guy and he says, you're probably going to believe him. Whereas if he's a 20-year-old scruffy kid in there, you're probably going to say, well, that kid was probably on drugs or something. But the truth is that 20-year-old kid probably knows what he's talking about. And the other guy doesn't.
It's kind of like if you're very sure the getaway car was a metallic mint green 1964 Buick Skylark convertible. But in fact, it wasn't. It was a 1963 Pontiac Tempest.
Well, that's funny. I used to have a Pontiac Tempest.
Did you really?
1968 Pontiac Tempest. It had the indestructible nose that they had on the commercial. The guy took a sledgehammer and hit it right on the nose with a sledgehammer. I think didn't do anything to it.
I think you talked about that before.
I think so. I think somebody put that up or something, too.
I was talking about my cousin Vinny. Remember that scene in there?
Yeah.
And she's talking about it. She's like, how do you know? It's like, it's a limited slip differential. Posi traction.
But that's true, though. It's these things, you get a picture in your mind of something, and that's the way it is.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't convince somebody otherwise. They're sure of that. Then you've got people putting pressure on you. We really need to know this. Is this right? And I was trying to remember there was some kind of a comedy show that I was watching. I want to say it was Dave Chappelle or something like that. And they were doing a lineup of who did it. And the only description they had is it was a black guy in jeans and a t-shirt or something like that. Mm-hmm. So they march in the lineup and it was Dave Chappelle in jeans and a t-shirt and, you know, like six other white guys in jeans and t-shirt. Now, can you pick one out?
Yeah.
Yes, it was him. Well, it wasn't, but you know, and his point was, hey, this is what happens. You may not notice it, but this is what happens in, you know, in some of these lineups. They don't use, you know, the right type of people in these things to when you're trying to actually get a good, you lead the witness in a way with it.
I think I could probably poke a few holes in that lineup.
You think so?
I think so.
Well, and they said that, you know, that there should be stricter laws enacted in how you do a lineup.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's lots of case law about lineups.
Like the people that are in there should not have any idea who the real person is. Mm-hmm. I mean, the police conducting it, the supervising people. Yeah. That way they can't knowingly or unknowingly lead the witness.
They do photo lineups too.
Yeah, and photo lineups, there's certain ways those should be done.
Yeah, there are.
And not, because there's a presumption by the witness that if you show me a photo lineup of like seven pictures there, one of them is the guy.
Yeah. It's like if they're holding up the thing, it's like, okay, I just need you to show which guy it was. And they have their thumb, you can't see right now, they have their thumb like this all the way down the sheet of paper.
Over just, one of their heads.
Which guy was it? And Their thumb starts tapping on it like tap, 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 tap.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's the one it is. Well, that's right. And that's, you know, those are the kind of things that can happen. And they say that you shouldn't, the comparative lineups are not as good as, like, if you're going to do it with photographs, as if you just show them one picture at a time and say, what about this person? Well, no, that one's not this or that. Well, no, that one's not this. And it makes you actually analyze the face in front of you instead of looking at all seven of them there together and picking the one that's most closely to what you remember.
Yeah.
That's more likely to lead to a false accusation.
False ID.
Yeah. Well, I had touched on earlier about racial bias when it comes to eyewitnesses. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to do with bias as far as prejudice against other races as it does against what you see and how close of attention you pay to it. Mm-hmm. As an example, they were citing this case. Miss Thompson Canino, who is white, had been a college student in North Carolina when she was attacked in 1984, and her African-American rapist had spent more than 20 minutes with her. She said, I studied every single detail of his face. I was going to make sure he was going to be put in prison. Later, after looking at suspect photos and viewing a lineup, I was confident I had picked the right guy, and he was going to jail, and if there was a death penalty, I would be there to pull the plug. Based largely on her emphatic testimony, Ronald Cotton was convicted and spent 11 years in prison until DNA showed that another convict named Bobby Poole had actually raped her. As she tried to grapple with this new information, Miss Thompson-Canino thought, when police showed her a photo of Mr. Poole, my mind would immediately say, oh my God, I was wrong. Study after study has shown that all of us have difficulty recognizing individuals from other racial or ethnic groups. So when Bobby's Poole picture didn't have an impact on her at all, and he didn't even look familiar, she just thought, I've failed everyone, and I'm a terrible human being.
Yeah.
White Americans have trouble recognizing Black Americans. White French people have trouble recognizing Arab immigrants. Chinese people have trouble recognizing Japanese people. Says, Mr. Cotton also thinks the cross-race effect helped put him behind bars. To him, he and Mr. Poole don't look a thing alike. But about 90% of white people think all Black people look alike. It's sad, but it's true, he said in an interview.
Yeah.
So of the first 239 people exonerated of their crimes through DNA evidence, like we talked about with the Innocence Project, about three quarters had been convicted based on inaccurate eyewitness identification.
That's a crazy statistic.
I know.
That's absurdly high.
I mean, that's way more than I would have ever thought.
Yeah.
And the struggle to recognize other race faces begins within the first year of our life as part of the natural development process. Oliver Pascal is an infant researcher at the French National Center of Scientific Research, showed that English and Chinese infants were equally good at 3 and 6 months in discriminating between faces of the opposite race. But Chinese infants at 9 months of age were showing discrimination only for Chinese faces and vice versa. He is not sure exactly why that happens, but it seems clear that we are designed to start focusing in on the most prevalent parts of our environment at a young age. I tell my students that this all may be similar to what happens when you train to become a good tennis player. You have to train the muscles that are used in that sport. If you also started out being a good soccer player, you may need to lose some of those abilities to become good at tennis. So, you know, it's just saying that these are some of the things that you have that cripple you in a way towards doing other things that you have to unlearn to be able to be better at it.
Well, I disagree because I'm a pretty good soccer player and I'm also a pretty good tennis player. So I think that doesn't make any sense.
But I doubt that you're at top levels of either one.
Well, what are you trying to say?
I'm trying to say there's room for improvement. You haven't reached that mark to where one would interfere with the other. You're like a run-of-the-mill athlete like me. You know, you just run around and do a little bit of everything.
You know.
Well, like I used to be. I'm not anymore. Now I'm a crippled old man. While most experts believe the cross-race effect is a natural part of human development, that doesn't make it any less of a problem in the criminal justice system in America. American courts rely more heavily on eyewitness identifications to convict defendants than in several other nations. We also know that whites are overrepresented as victims and witnesses, and blacks are overrepresented as defendants in criminal cases. Racial prejudice is not the driving force in our struggle to recognize faces outside our own group, yet the cross-race phenomenon is often the start of the process that leads to wrongful conviction. What happens is a witness identifies a suspect. The suspect then becomes the culprit. The police stop gathering information on any other possible suspect.
Yeah, they focus on that one person.
Then the officer goes to forensic scientist and says, I have a suspect. I know it's my guy, but I need the evidence to go with it. And finally, he has a suspect come in and he interrogates him in ways that too often lead to a false confession. This chain of events often starts, though, because a white witness makes an honest mistake in identifying a black suspect from a photo array or a physical lineup. When police ask a witness to come in to see if he can identify a suspect, most witnesses assume that the target is present, because why would the police bring them in if the target wasn't present? So if the suspect belongs to another race, the witness may then identify someone who looks similar to the face he remembers, but who is not that person. It's not usually done out of spite or bias, the doctor says, but because the witness doesn't want to say he can't remember somebody. He wants to please the officers.
I think that was also the case in that making the murder thing, too. It seemed like that Brandon wanted to please the officers and try to help them out because he was, you know, that's how a lot of times they present it. Like, why don't you help us out here? You know, do yourself a favor, too.
Yeah, and that's not really, they weren't doing him a favor at all. They were setting him up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, there's lots of different things to that, and they equated it. It's the same thing. It's just things you become aware of. And it's like one of the researchers said, that she didn't pay any attention to, you know, dog species until she decided to get a dog and she got a border collie. After she got a border collie, she then would notice different types of border collies and could identify them and the different features that they had and stuff like that. But before then, she just merely said, that's a dog, or that's a border collie, if, you know, if any identification at all.
Yeah.
But just lumped them in as a group. So it wasn't until later. So they say it's the same type thing. If you're white and you deal mostly with white people, you pick up on features and things like that are prevalent. That way, then, when you see a black person, then you just say, well, that's a black person, and that's as far as it goes. You don't develop on the characteristics. And it's not a knowing thing. It's just a thing that is developed in there, and it's kind of like one of those things when you're under stress. When you're under stress, you have to make a quick evaluation. So your mind doesn't go into details. It goes into quick jumps of, is this us or them? Whereas if everything is calm and peaceful, then you have more time to take your time and study things and see, you know, be creative and what's actually there. But the problem is, when you're a witness in a crime, most of the time it's a stressful situation. Whether yeah. you're involved or not, if you're just standing across the street and see it, it's still going to be stressful to you.
Absolutely.
So you're not operating under prime conditions, and that leads to a lot of these mistakes.
Well, one of the cases that was really kind of popular recently was the serial case, the podcast, Adnan Syed. And recently, he was granted a new trial. So he's not free just yet, but he was granted a new trial.
Well, that was a real battle just to get the trial.
It was.
A retrial.
The Maryland Court of Special Appeals issued a 132-page opinion, basically going on the statements that there was ineffective assistance of counsel at his original trial. And the main reason for that, if you ever listen to the podcast, you remember, is because his trial attorney failed to call an alibi witness.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically could say, hey, he couldn't have done it at the time whenever that took place because I saw him at the library. And the attorney did not call that person, and that ended up being the basis for this ineffective assistance of counsel. I think there were some other things thrown in there too. But pretty much the ineffective assistance of counsel argument, it's kind of a last-ditch effort. It's really one of the few things you throw at the wall at the very end. Because there's been cases where attorneys have been sleeping in court, they've been drunk, they've had a lot of health issues during a trial. And basically these appeals courts have said, no, you know, maybe it could have been better, but we don't see a problem with that outcome.
Wow.
So in order to prevail on ineffective assistance of counsel claim like this is pretty hard. So now there's a couple different outcomes for what could happen in this case now that it's been ordered for a new trial. The state could appeal that to the Supreme Court, and if the court decides to not hear it, then basically they would have to go back for another trial. Now, the problem with this case is he's been in jail for about 18 years or so. So if they decide they want to retry him on this, they're going to have to reindict him and all of this whole thing. And
so you're looking at more years.
Well, but they're going to have to try to reconstruct their case. I mean, these witnesses, whoever they're it's just going to be a huge problem for him. And they're probably not going to want to retry him on that case.
Mm-hmm.
So usually what happens in a case like this is that they'll offer him some sort of plea deal, which will basically be, hey, you're already going to get out.
Mm-hmm.
If you take it now, you're out. Mm-hmm. If not, we're going to go to trial. Or who knows? They may just say, you know what? We're not going to try it again. You're free to go. So that opinion issued, I believe, on March 29th, and they had 30 days. So we should have an answer probably coming pretty soon as to what the state's going to do with regards to that case. But that was one of those ones that was really interesting and kind of took the country by storm here recently. Wow. In the past couple of years. So
it's amazing some of the things that happen when you read about these things. There's one of the stories that I looked at in here, and a guy was convicted of a double murder in Brooklyn, and he was in Florida at the time and had a multitude of witnesses saying he was down there for the birth of a child of his, and yet they still convicted him of it. And he finally got out after serving like 19 and a half years of a minimum 20-year sentence. He finally got out, but they were going to pardon him. He wanted a retrial because he wanted to be cleared of it.
Yeah.
He wanted those witnesses brought in, wanted to be cleared of it. And they're like, his lawyer's like, no, you don't want to do that, dude. They're letting you go. He goes, no, I want the retrial, and I want them to do it right, and I want to be cleared of this. I don't want this hanging over me. I didn't get out on a technicality. I didn't do it.
Yeah. A man of principle.
Yeah.
What took place? Did he have another trial? Do we know?
they haven't had the trial yet. They haven't tried. It just recently happened.
Now, a lot of, like you said, a lot of the DNA convict or a lot of convictions are overturned because of DNA evidence. And one of the more interesting and bizarre cases was right here in West Virginia with Fred Zane. And
Fred Zane was bizarre.
Yeah, he was a West Virginia State Police forensic expert, and he basically testified in hundreds of criminal cases. He was a very good witness. He presented himself well. He seemed like he knew what he was talking about. And basically, defense attorneys didn't really question his laboratory results or his methodology too much. They just kind of basically went with it. They didn't get into that.
Told him what they needed, and he found it.
Yeah, and juries believed what he had to say. And they convicted defendants when Zane testified. And basically, he was not actually testing a lot of the stuff and actually trying to make the results conform to whatever he wanted them to be.
Right.
Because of his success in the courtroom, he became kind of a forensic star, and prosecutors everywhere really wanted to bring him in because he was winning all these cases.
Yeah. But he was making it up.
Yeah. And so basically his stars started shining so bright here in West Virginia that it led him to a better job as a chief physical evidence for the medical examiner in Bexar County, Texas. And basically he did what he did for West Virginia. He kept winning and winning these cases and kept lying. And basically what the story seems to be that Fred Zane was, although he did end up incarcerating a lot of people unjustly, he didn't really set out to be kind of a bad guy and do this. He had kind of a lot of things going against him. The main which is that he really did not have the background to even do this kind of job.
Right. He was just basically inept. He wasn't malicious. He was just inept.
Yeah. He was really never qualified to do the job to begin with. His college transcript showed that he was just basically a mediocre student, and he actually failed organic chemistry.
And I don't think he understood the DNA process or testing or anything else. I think he just, the cops would come in and tell him what they needed, and he'd say, okay, I'll get you that result. And he did it, and he just hoped the cops gave him the right guy.
Yeah, and so basically what he did is he did kind of backwards reasoning like you were talking about. He said if the defendant is guilty, it's likely that, and that was how he started going backwards, working the case that way. Mm-hmm. And he just wasn't an expert. Now, the way this all came to a head, I don't know if you remember the case that broke this loose.
No, I don't remember.
Well, I'm sure you will once I talk about it, because it was Glendale Woodall.
Oh, yeah.
And he was kind of a local, I guess, villain here for a while.
Yeah.
He was convicted
of a rape.
Yeah, in 1987 of multiple felonies, including two counts of sexual assault, mm-hmm. and a sentence to a prison term of 203 to 335 years. And basically, he was known as the mall rapist. Mm-hmm. And this was back when I was kind of growing up. It was really kind of weird, scary time because there was a couple rapes that were committed at the mall. And that mall is brand new, too.
Yeah.
I think it was like 3 or 4 years old at mm-hmm. that time. So it was kind of a big deal around here. Zane testified at the trial, and based upon a scientific analysis of the semen recovered from the victims, the assailant's blood types were identical to Mr. Woodall's. And Woodall was convicted, and it was affirmed on appeal. But basically, they did some subsequent DNA testing. It was through a habeas corpus proceeding that we talked about earlier, and it established that he could not have been the perpetrator based on this DNA evidence, and his conviction was overturned in 1992, and he was actually freed. Woodall sued the state of West Virginia for false imprisonment, and he got $1 million in a settlement for it. And basically, this case led to an investigation of all of Zane's work, because he had testified at that trial and basically said it had to be this guy based on this blood work. Mm-hmm. The report by the West Virginia Supreme Court concluded that 134 people, that their guilt was actually in doubt because of the testimony by Zane.
Yeah, there have been quite a few set free since then.
Yeah, 9 men have been freed because of the remaining evidence was insufficient for conviction. Mm-hmm. So now the other people who helped Zane commit this fraud didn't really understand. They said, a former superintendent of the West Virginia State Police said, "I really have no idea what he did or why he did what he did." So they was like, I don't understand why.
He was over his head.
Yeah.
That's all it was. He was over his head and just trying to protect his job.
Ray Barber, who was the lab chief at the time, said he felt no need to check Zane's credentials because Zane had a lab background as a chemist with the Department of Natural Resources. And here's
testing water and stuff.
In 1985, I guess, two fellow lab workers told superiors they had seen Zane record results from blank test plates.
That's good. You are damn good when you can record results from blank ones.
And Kenneth Blake, who was the director of the State Police Criminal Identification Bureau, he basically looked into the allegations and dismissed them as an office squabble. He said they didn't like Zane and Zane didn't like them, but we never had any complaints from prosecutors, defense attorneys, or investigators.
No, of course not, because he kept giving them what they wanted.
So, in an ironic twist, he was charged in Hondo, Texas, with aggravated perjury, evidence tampering, and fabrication connected to a 1990 rape conviction, and he was acquitted. And basically, he was actually charged again in West Virginia, but those charges were dismissed as well. So he
never went to jail or anything for this stuff he did.
No. He's dead now.
Oh, well, good. Karma got him.
That's pretty recently.
Yeah?
Yeah. He died down in Florida.
Oh. Well, so, Florida's killed a lot of people.
It has.
That's where criminals go to die.
Now, like I said, he was the mall rapist, and so the guy was actually... There was an unsolved mystery for a while. And eventually, this guy named Donald Good... And he ended up being convicted in 2011 of being the mall rapist after being charged in 2010 after it was discovered that his DNA and fingerprints matched the attacker, who the attacker was. And so basically, he got some other kind of crime. I think he committed a murder in Kanawha County. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they tested
his... He was in the database.
Yeah. He was in the database. They ran mm-hmm. through that and said, hey, we've got the guy. So they tried him in Cabell County, and he was sentenced by... My good friend, Judge Al Ferguson, who I used to clerk for, mm-hmm. he was sentenced to two life sentences followed by 162 additional years, which are to run consecutive to his life sentence for murder out of Kanawha County.
You know, what I never knew, this Glendale Woodall, there was a guy that was on my little league team that I played baseball with. It was a year ahead of me, and his name was Glenn Woodall.
Really?
And I never knew if it was the same guy or not. We never called him Glendale, and I didn't know what his middle name was, but he was the right age. And I always wondered if it was a guy that I played Little League baseball with. We weren't living here then when all that took place. That was during the time that we lived away.
You all lived in Georgia, didn't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we lived away. So I wasn't here really when I was going on. I saw about some of it in the paper and everything, but I never saw the pictures and all that because you didn't have the interweb and yeah. all that to see all everything that was going on. You were actually relied on newspapers. So
they actually just, speaking of... convictions and whatnot, they caught that serial killer and serial rapist in California today.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Hmm. So I just saw it in the headline. I didn't really read too much about it, but it was through DNA evidence.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
You know, there's been talk, and I know that everybody gets all up in arms about it and everything, but there's been talk about making everybody register their DNA and have everybody in a database. So Ooh. If you do things like that, they can fix you. But the first thing they got to do is get a national database. I know that it's good for most things, but not everything gets entered into it.
Well, I mean, if you've already submitted your DNA to one of those testing services, there's probably already another one of you out there walking around.
There's another one of you walking around? They've cloned you?
They've cloned you.
Dolly the sheep?
That's right. Tommy the sheep. No.
Back off.
No, but I think whatever you agree to in those things is pretty egregious. Like, you give them the right to your DNA and all kinds of stuff in these agreements.
And they sell it to the government?
Probably.
For the database?
That's right.
Well, I know I'll get a lot of pushback from it, but I don't know that wouldn't be all bad. I say we chip everybody. I think if everybody had a chip, then we'd know who did what. And yeah. then there'd be no question, be no false convictions. And your chip would have cleared you or convicted you.
You ain't sticking no chip in me.
Yeah, when you go to sleep and you just wake up the next morning and you're just scratching your head, a little scratch, a little itch.
Unless it's a Cool Ranch Dorito in my mouth, because those are delicious.
One of those kind of chips? No, I'm talking about a microchip, pal.
Yeah,
we're going to microchip everybody.
Not happening.
Yeah.
So there's one more person I wanted to talk about, and this was probably the most famous, well-known, wrongfully convicted person of all time. He was actually a well-known vascular surgeon in Chicago, Dr. Richard Kimball.
Oh, yeah. He was the fugitive.
That's right.
He's what the show was based on.
The one-armed man killed his wife.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Can't forget about him.
No, you can't forget about him.
So I think that's going to bring us to...
Legal Briefs. How is that funny? We do that every week.
I was just thinking about I got a kick out of my fact that I brought up Dr. Richard Kimball.
Oh. Well, I remembered him.
He did. Did you realize
David Jansen?
Did you realize where I was going with that?
Well, I knew as soon as you said the name, I knew that was what it was.
But when I talked about a famous vascular surgeon in Chicago?
No, not till you said Dr. Richard Kimball. Oh, okay. Then I knew who you were talking about.
Okay. So you thought it was good delivery then, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. You sound just like William Shatner.
Damn it, Tommy. that's Bones.
Damn it, Jim. I'm a doctor, not a mechanic.
The dilithium crystals are almost drained as it is. We can't go much further. All right, that's our segment called Bad Star Trek Impersonations.
Hey, speaking of bad Star Trek, this isn't Star Trek, but have you seen that they have redone the Lost in Space series? And it's on Netflix now?
Is it really?
Yeah, it's a brand new re-envisioning of Lost in Space. When I was a kid, that was one of my favorite shows. I wanted to be Will Robinson.
Yeah, and it had the robot, and then it had the kind of cowardly doctor guy.
Danger, danger, run, Will Robinson, run, Will Robinson.
Kind of smarmy doctor guy.
Was Dr. That? Smith. And Dr. Smith is a female in this new reimagined version of it.
Really?
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, but I understand it's been released on Netflix, I guess, and I got to see that. I got to see how it compares to the original.
Yeah. Well, now, the first term I'm going to bring up is one that you should have known was going to happen. Habeas corpus.
Habeas corpus. That means present the body.
Produce the body, but yes, present the body is fine. And what is procedurally a habeas corpus?
That's how you get back into court to get a retrial.
Okay.
It's a writ of habeas corpus.
It is. And it's usually something that's filed after all other remedies have been exhausted. And the appeal basically has been denied, and there's been some sort of new evidence or new discovery in the case. And you're saying basically that the person being detained is being wrongfully detained, and that's kind of the essence of what a habeas corpus claim is.
That's what they're doing with Stephen Avery, because they're saying that there's cell phone data that's indicating that lady left his junkyard.
That's true.
And that they've got to find that. They've presented that as new evidence.
I feel kind of bad asking this question because this is something you presented. What is the least reliable yet commonly relied upon method of conviction?
Eyewitness news.
That's right. And part of the reason why you said that was it has to do with the fact that our memory is not like a video recording, but more like pieces of puzzles.
Exactly. It can be easily influenced.
Yep.
And we will swear to those memories that we have.
That's right. Now, what is a forensic interview?
A forensic interview is one that is conducted very carefully and videotaped so that you can see it. And it usually has to do with children when you're trying to recreate what happened to them, trying to determine exactly what happened. So you don't want to lead them into something or plant something there that wasn't there.
That's right. And it's supposed to be a very sterile environment where you don't plant thoughts into a child their thoughts are easily influenced.
Correct.
Now, whenever you are wrongfully imprisoned, you would file suit against that state for wrongfully imprisoning you. Now, in Florida, there is a cap for it. What is the cap?
$2 million.
And how much is it a year?
$50,000.
And what if you're on death row?
It's $10,000.
Wrong way.
$20,000.
$100,000.
Oh, $100,000. I forgot I was going from $10,000. It was twice whatever it was.
Yeah, and I don't actually. $100,000. And just here's a caveat. I don't know if that's actually Florida or not. It's just somewhere I read that. I threw it in there. But I thought that was kind of interesting. That $50,000 for regular prison, $100,000 for death row.
Yeah, well, you're under more stress. You know, when you talk about false memories, it's like when you've heard stories told to you, like when your parents tell you something that when you were a kid, this happened.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear that enough, you kind of create that memory in your head. And there's things that I've been told before that I think I remember them, but I don't know if I really remember them or if I've just constructed the story from hearing them tell it.
Yeah.
Well, it's like my parents tell me about when I was like 2 and a half, we went out to Kansas. Some relative of my mom's had died and we went out there for a funeral. So while we were there, they were staying at a farm and there were horses. And so they took us horseback riding. So they put me up on my own horse, and my parents were each on a horse, and they was just real slow. They're walking them. You know, there was a person walking them along as we were riding them, and they hadn't cinched mine very tight. So as we were walking along, the saddle started sliding to the side a little bit more, till finally it dropped around, and I was under the horse, but hanging on to the saddle still. And it's like the guy was walking along, and he didn't notice it, and finally turned around and says, "Oh!" And everybody stops. Ah, grab my baby. And they get me off the horse. And they're like, you know, weren't you, you know, why didn't you say something or something? He's like, you're 2 and a half. you just think it's part of the ride. You don't know. Now, in my mind, I remember this happening, but I'm sure that it must be that they've told me that story so many times, I've created that scene in my head of how it must have been.
Kind of like whenever I went on a date with you and Mary and I stuck Rocky Road into my head.
Now, that happened. That happened. You had long hair. Your mom had not cut your hair. And most people, when they saw you, would say, oh, what a cute little girl. And you'd look at him and say, you dumb womans, I'm a boy, I'm not a girl. And so we had you sitting at Baskin-Robbins eating ice cream, your favorite walkie woad, and you were leaning forward and your blonde hair was hanging and getting in your ice cream. And I said, Michael, be careful, you're going to get that ice cream in your hair. And you looked at the ice cream cone, and you looked at me and smiled. You picked up the ice cream cone and went whop right in the side of the head, just smashed it right into your hair.
See, I don't have really, I don't think, I couldn't have possibly remember that, but I actually remember from being told that story so many times it happening.
So you it's like you do remember it.
Yeah.
So we created that memory in your head that you don't remember.
Kind of like me whenever we built a bike ramp for me to jump off my bike.
You don't remember that? You were about 11 then, weren't
yeah.
you?
Yeah. Well, I think it's probably because I had a concussion.
Well, that's probably true. You have CTE.
I have no recollection of me actually coming off that bike ramp and crashing, burning, getting dirt in my teeth.
Yeah, you were sitting on the back of my 72 Plymouth Fury when you stuck that ice cream cone in your hair.
Yeah, you've had quite the collection of cars over the years.
Yeah, yeah, old beaters, every one of them. Hey, there's two other big updates that we needed to tell.
Uh-oh.
One was monkeys cannot have intellectual property.
Okay.
They cannot file for a copyright if you're a monkey. So don't even think about it. If you're a monkey and you listen to this podcast, don't even think about filing for any copyrights. You can't do it. The Ninth Circuit Court decided monkeys cannot copyright anything.
Ruling on cases that matter.
That's right. And then also, in case you've been following it, Meek Mill was released yesterday.
Who?
The rapper, Meek Mill, from Philadelphia. You don't know about him?
I do not.
Well, he was one that... He wasn't wrongfully convicted, but there was a lot of circumstances that just weren't right. He's been in and out of prison a lot over the last 10 years, and most of it has been because, it's like you said in our one when we talked about probation, sometimes it's better just to go to jail and serve your time and be out than be on probation.
Yeah.
He was given a sentence that he only served 6 months of, then they put him on about 4 years probation, then they got him on probation violation, put him back in and gave him 5 more years of probation. So the poor guy's been on probation all the time. They had two crimes against him that they ended up dropping the charges on, but they still decided he violated his probation and put him in jail for another 4 years. And it just hasn't seemed fair. You have a judge that there seemed to be some impropriety in how she handled him. She sent him to etiquette classes because she thought he needed it for his social interaction. And she also advised him off the record that he should drop the label he was with and sign for a person that's a personal friend of hers. So, I don't know, there's just a lot of strange things. But anyway, this guy is just, it's just been a terrible example of the criminal justice system at work. All the things that are worst about it, this was it. And he's had a lot of high-level people working to bring his situation to light. And
hashtag free Meek.
Free Meek Mill. But he says that he's going to take this platform that he's got, and he's going to, because there's a whole lot of people that don't have this type of publicity to back them up, and they're in the same situation. Mm-hmm. And he wants to try to revise the criminal justice system from these type of things, and I hope he's successful.
Yeah. But like I said, I did say that sometimes it is better just to go ahead and go to prison, get your term over with, and get out and get probation, because you're going to sometimes these people, they know they're going to screw up, and they'll choose to go to prison instead of taking probation or something like that, because they just rather get it over with.
Well, that's what Meek would have rather done if he had his choice. And, you know, probate, one of the violations was he tested positive for marijuana. And we talked about, why was marijuana made a Schedule I drug in the first place?
Yeah.
To go after minorities. And, you know, here it is, still there. That's another reason that we need to decriminalize marijuana.
Amen.
Besides the testing factor.
Testing factor.
Yeah, you can't test on it. You can't test it at universities and things like that.
They need to see if there are any kind of benefits for it.
Yes, or what the bad things are, side effects and everything. Yeah. They need to do thorough testing. They now have a drug that you can use that has some of the stuff from marijuana without the THC. So it's supposed to be a very good benefit for seizures, I think.
There's a lot of drugs that are like Schedule 3 and Schedule 4 that are way worse than marijuana.
Yeah. They've talked about that they see where they've done some tests and that it would drop opioid use.
Yeah. Well, maybe one day.
Well, until then, we'll just have to wait till the next 420.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship, court-appointed. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new laws. To seek out new life and new puns. To boldly go where no man has gone before. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well then, not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out though, right?
Usually. This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf.